the situation in Iraq. Yesterday, I convened a meeting with my National Security Council to discuss the situation there, and this morning I received an update from my team. Over the last several days, we've seen significant gains made by ISIL, a terrorist organization that operates in both Iraq and in Syria. In the face of a terrorist offensive, Iraqi security forces have proven unable to defend a number of cities, which has allowed the terrorists to overrun a part of Iraq's territory. And this poses a danger to Iraq and its people. And given the nature of these terrorists, it could pose a threat eventually to American interests as well. Now, this threat is not brand new. Over the last year, we've been steadily ramping up our security assistance to the Iraqi government with increased training, equipping, and intelligence. Now, Iraq needs additional support to break the momentum of extremist groups and bolster the capabilities of Iraqi security forces. We will not be sending U.S. troops back into combat in Iraq, but I have asked my national security team to prepare a range of other options that could help support Iraq security forces, and I'll be reviewing those options in the days ahead. I do want to be clear, though, this is not solely or even primarily a military challenge. Over the past decade, American troops have made extraordinary sacrifices to give Iraqis an opportunity to claim their own future. Unfortunately, Iraqis' leaders have been unable to overcome too often the mistrust and sectarian differences that have long been simmering there. And that's created vulnerabilities within the Iraqi government as well as their security forces. So, any action that we may take to provide assistance to Iraqi security forces has to be joined by a serious and sincere effort by Iraq's leaders to set aside sectarian differences, to promote stability, and account for the legitimate interests of all of Iraq's communities, and to continue to build the capacity of an effective security force. We can't do it for them. And in the absence of this type of political effort, short-term military action, including any assistance we might provide, won't succeed. So this should be a wake-up call. Iraq's leaders have to demonstrate a willingness to make hard decisions and compromises on behalf of the Iraqi people in order to bring the country together. In that effort, they will have the support of the United States and our friends and our allies. Now, Iraq's neighbors also have some responsibilities to support this process. Nobody has an interest in seeing terrorists gain a foothold inside of Iraq, and nobody is going to benefit from seeing Iraq descend into chaos. So the United States will do our part, but understand that ultimately it's up to the Iraqis as a sovereign nation to solve their problems. Indeed, across the region, we have redoubled our efforts to help build more capable counterterrorism forces so that groups like ISIL can't establish safe haven. And we'll continue that effort through our support of the moderate opposition in Syria, our support for Iraq and its security forces, and our partnership with other countries across the region. We're also going to pursue intensive diplomacy throughout this period, both inside of Iraq and across the region, because there's never going to be stability in Iraq or the broader region unless there are political outcomes that allow people to resolve their differences peacefully without resorting to war or relying on the United States military. We'll be monitoring the situation in Iraq very carefully over the next several days. Our top priority will remain being vigilant against any threats to our personnel serving overseas. We will consult closely with Congress as we make determinations about appropriate action, and we'll continue to keep the American people fully informed as we make decisions about the way forward. All right, I'll take a question.
In recent U.S. history there, are you reluctant to get involved again in Iraq?
I think that we should look at the situation carefully. We have an interest in making sure that a group like ISIL, which is a vicious organization and has been able to take advantage of the chaos in Syria, that they don't get a broader foothold. I think there are dangers of fierce sectarian fighting if, for example, the terrorist organizations try to overrun sacred Shia sites, which could trigger Shia-Sunni conflicts that could be very hard to stamp out. So we have enormous interest there, and obviously Our troops and the American people and the American taxpayers made huge investments and sacrifices in order to give Iraqis the opportunity to chart a better course, a better destiny. But ultimately, they're going to have to seize it. As I said before, we are not going to be able to do it for them. And, you know, given the very difficult history that we've seen in Iraq, I think that any objective observer would recognize that in the absence of accommodation among the various factions inside of Iraq, various military actions by the United States, by any outside nation, are not going to solve those problems over the long term and not going to deliver the kind of stability that we need. Anybody else?
Mr. President, is the Syrian civil war spilling over the Iraq border?
Well, I think that's been happening for some time. ISIL has been able to gain a foothold in Syria. That's part of the reason why we've been so concerned about it. That's part of the reason why we've been supporting the Syrian opposition there. But it's a challenging problem. In Iraq, the Iraqi government, which was initially resistant to some of our offers of help, has come around now to recognize that cooperation with us on some of these issues can be useful. Obviously, that's not the case in Syria, where President Assad has no interest in seeing us involved there, and where some of the governments that are supporting Assad have been able to block, for example, UN efforts, even at humanitarian aid. But this is a regional problem, and it is going to be a long-term problem. And what we're going to have to do is combine selective actions by our military to make sure that we're going after terrorists who could harm our personnel overseas or eventually hit the homeland. We're going to have to combine that with what is a very challenging international effort to try to rebuild countries and communities that have been shattered by sectarian war. And that's not an easy task.
What are they willing to do as part of this international effort?
Well, we're in contact with them now. So we'll have a better sense by the end of the weekend after those consultations. And we will be getting a better sense from them of how they might support an effort to bring about the kind of political unity inside of Iraq that bolsters security forces. Look, the United States has poured a lot of money into these Iraqi security forces, and we devoted a lot of training to Iraqi security forces. The fact that they are not willing to stand and fight and defend their posts against admittedly hardened terrorists, but not terrorists who are overwhelming in numbers, indicates that there's a problem with morale, there's a problem in terms of commitment, and ultimately that's rooted in the political problems that have plagued the country for a very long time. Last question. Last one.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about U.S. concern of the disruption, potential disruption of oil supplies?
Well, so far at least, we have not seen major disruptions in oil supplies. Obviously, if in fact ISIL was able to obtain control over major output, significant refineries, that could be a source of concern. As you might expect, world oil markets react to any kind of instability in the Middle East. One of our goals should be to make sure that in cooperation with other countries in the region, not only are we creating some sort of backstop in terms of what's happening inside of Iraq, but if there do end up being disruptions inside of Iraq, that some of the other producers in the Gulf are able to pick up the slack. So that'll be part of the consultations that'll be taking place during the course of this week. Just to give people a sense of timing here, although events on the ground in Iraq have been happening very quickly, our ability to plan, whether it's military action or work with the Iraqi government on some of these political issues, is going to take several days. So people should not anticipate that this is something that is going to happen overnight. We want to make sure that we have good eyes on the situation there. We want to make sure that We've gathered all the intelligence that's necessary so that if, in fact, I do direct and order any actions there, that they're targeted, they're precise, and they're going to have an effect. And as I indicated before, and I want to make sure that everybody understands this message, the United States is not simply going to involve itself in a military action in the absence of a political plan by the Iraqis that gives us some assurance that they're prepared to work together. We're not going to allow ourselves to be dragged back into a situation in which, while we're there, we're keeping a lid on things, and after enormous sacrifices by us, as soon as we're not there, suddenly people end up acting in ways that are not conducive to the long-term stability and prosperity of the country. All right? Thank you very much, everybody.
Sergeant Bergdahl, now that he's home.
All right, so there he is, the President of the United States. An important statement by the President saying...
These idiot reporters.
For the government
Bergdahl.
In effect in Baghdad to make the kind of
airstrikes or not, Mr. President. Did you say... Did he say anything? Did I miss it?
Some of the blame on the current unrest...
Did I space out at the part where he said whether or not he's going to bomb them? I heard him say, well, no troops on the ground, by which he means right now. Or as far as you know, or something like that. But did he go from, well, no troops, straight to, you know, the Iraqis gotta, you know, meet Jesus halfway here, or what? He just refused to announce anything, and then every follow-up question was some nothing. Bergdahl. God. Ugh. Well, welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. That was the President of the United States. I'm not sure if he said anything. We're going to provide assistance to the Iraqis. That's it. I'm not disappointed that he's not promising worse behavior. I would have liked a little bit of clarity. That's all. Just a little clarity. I have to admit, I like his attitude overall. However, he's completely full of it. Completely full of it. For one thing, Iraq is a sovereign nation. No, it's not. And the fact is, at this point, as everyone in the whole wide world who's not a damn liar but who actually knows something about this would tell you, the government in Baghdad, the Shiite government in Baghdad, the Dawah Party government in Baghdad, whatever they call it now, is not going to be able to conquer the West. Not unless the U.S., Russia, China, and Iran all team up to back them and start the whole damn war all over again. The results of the Iraq war, again for the zillionth time, here anyway, the Shia got everything from Baghdad to Basra. They kicked all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. The Sunni Arabs got the Anbar province and up toward Mosul. And then there's Kurdistan, and Kurdistan is mostly in alliance with the Shiite South. Even though they're Sunnis, they're Kurds, a different ethnicity, and a repressed a severely repressed group under the rule of the Sunni Arabs under Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists. So that's basically how it's been, and it's already divided into three states. It already is. As I was trying to explain on the show yesterday, maybe you picked up on it, America backed those among the Shiites who would divide Iraq in three. If you listen to this show back in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, you learned all along from the likes of, you know, Bob Dreyfus and Patrick Coburn and Dar Jamail and all these others that the Supreme Islamic Council, they were loyal to Iran. And Iran didn't want all of Iraq. They just wanted Baghdad and everything from Baghdad to Basra. It would be stupid. It would be like an American thing to do, to bite off way more than they could chew and really try to take the rest of, you know, the majority Sunni provinces. There's been plenty of sectarian cleansing there, too, where Shiites have fled to more Shiite territory. This is the result of America's civil war there on behalf of the Shia. And so there is no sovereign nation. And Lord Maliki has no authority. He has no support, no popular sovereignty whatsoever in the Sunni areas of the country. That doesn't mean they all love ISIS, but it meant even the New York Times had this giant thing. I don't know, even the New York Times. The New York Times had a giant thing about, man, a lot of people in Mosul are saying, good riddance to the Iraqi army. They may not like, you know, the rule of these new guys. But then again, back in 2006 and 2007, the Sunni Iraqis proved that they were not about to be bossed around by a bunch of foreigners and beat their asses right down again in the so-called awakening, after their so-called help was no longer welcome. But anyway, so there's, first of all, no indication that Maliki would want to compromise, does want to compromise, would ever compromise with the Sunni Arabs or include them in the government or anything like that. He hasn't done that this whole time, and he has no interest in doing that. But the one Shiite Arab leader in Iraq who had some moral authority, actual legit moral authority from the people, and who wanted to keep Iraq together and not have a sectarian war, at least at first, was Muqtada al-Sadr. He wanted the Iranians out and the Americans out. So the Americans marginalized him in favor of the pro-Iranians, who kicked us out too. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here. Man. So did you also catch Obama in there saying that, well, first of all, the bottom line is he's asked his National Security Council to come up with some options, and he'll get back to us in a few days about what he means by that. Spencer Ackerman is reporting in The Guardian that they're working on airstrikes. The article is Obama, quote, urgently considering air assault on targets in Syria and Iraq. It's amazing the dishonesty that underlies everything. They can't even just tell you the basic. I mean, don't get me wrong. They could lie by omission about a whole lot of things, right? About, you know, history, how things got this way, what they really want. They could lie about all of that. But for the narrative to be so confused that Obama can literally sit here and say that the problem here is the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, that is the exact same Sunni-based insurgency in Syria, and that's why we're going to keep backing the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria without everybody's head exploding, except for mine, I guess, is an incredible thing. It'll go down in history as bigger and better and worser than the media going along with the weapons of mass destruction crap against Iraq, which was completely ridiculous. Iraq, the weakest state in the world, is the biggest threat in the world at the very same time, huh, guys? Well, yeah, in this case, there are no moderates, you know. Maybe there are some moderates, but the FSA, but where are they? Mitchell Prothero, the McClatchy newspaper guy, said, well, you know, there are some of these guys, but yeah, I mean, even I call them hotel revolutionaries. Yeah, big fat CIA paid expats who sit around and do nothing. The guys out there fighting are the guys who don't mind dying. They're the guys who really mean it. They're the guys from ISIS and Nusra. It's their war. He says, yeah, you know, they're moderates in that. There are some of these groups that they're really not, you know, hardcore bin Ladenites, but they're mostly, yeah, gangsters and criminals and hustlers and thieves. Yeah. Remember John McCain telling, John Kerry telling John McCain in testimony, Secretary of State testifying before the Senate last summer and saying, oh yeah, you know, the rebels? Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of them are, you know, moderate, secular. And it was just like, dude, really? Come on. I forget now whether the peanut gallery really broke out laughing or that was just me. But I think it was actually pretty widely received as preposterous. And the likes of the New York Times and the Washington Post and every major publication, all the British publications, all the different newspapers, it's not really part of the narrative, but they have all run stories that describe how American weapons and money and Saudi and Qatari and Turkish and Jordanian weapons and money that flow to the so-called moderate rebels in Syria all end up in the hands of the jihadists. Of course. That's been reported over and over and over again for 3 years running now. There's no secret to that. Everybody knows that. There's a story at the Long War Journal that Daniel McAdams linked to over at the Ron Paul Institute a couple of weeks ago where, remember the stories of the TOW missiles? America gives TOW missiles to the moderates. Next thing you know, they're in the hands of the Islamic Front. Well, what's the Islamic Front? That's just a new name for the receiving weapons from the West division of Jabhat al-Nusra. And even the head of the Islamic Front, this which basically seems like a front, you know, for al-Nusra, even he has said, yeah, oh yeah, I'm loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and the goals of al-Qaeda. Like, that's just rote. That's what they all have to say in order to not get whacked out in the field out there. And the ISIS guys used to be. Now, Zawahiri ordered them into Iraq and they refused. But then, and then even killed his emissary that he sent to tell them to go back to Iraq. Now they've gone back to Iraq on their own time and shown Zawahiri they don't need him to boss them around. So, I mean, what would you expect of these guys? You know, hopefully they break into more and more pieces and kill each other more and more. If that's how they got to be, a bunch of warring bin Ladenites. But Obama in his speech just now in his White House lawn statement just said that, yeah, it's true, you know. That was one of the questions. It was a very uninformed and nonspecific kind of question. But is the civil war from Syria coming over the border into Iraq? Well, yeah, that's what we've been talking about this whole time, the rise of this new caliphate thing that doesn't respect that border at all. It's the very same group, ISIS, ISIL. That's what those letters mean, man. Iraq and the Levant, that's Syria. Or the Sham, that's the Levant. Syria and Lebanon and that area, that region of the Eastern Mediterranean there. And Obama says, yeah, and that's why we have to back the rebels more. You know, the moderate ones. Are you kidding me? And nobody's calling him on this. Long War Journal has American TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles, in the hands of the al-Nusra Front, which are actually more loyal to bin Laden's old organization than the guys that are taking over Iraq right now. And listen, there's only one explanation for this, and you know what it is. Israel. There's only one reason that Obama right now is not saying we are allying with Maliki, with Iran, and with Syria, the Assad government, the Shiite, Baathist, secularist dictatorship, against these guys. There's only one reason. Israel. Israel hates Iran. Israel hates Hezbollah. Hezbollah's backed by Syria's backed by Iran. Oh, the Shiite crescent. It doesn't matter that, because that's what Ariel Sharon wanted, America went in there and did a regime change in Iraq and empowered the Iranians and gave, as I was describing a million times over and just now, gave all the land up to and including Baghdad all the way to Basra to Iran's sock puppets in the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council. Doesn't matter. that America just fought an 8-year war for Iran in Iraq. Because that's what Israel wanted in the first place, because Ariel Sharon's a stupid idiot. But anyway, so why can't America, like George Bush used to do, George Bush used to pay Bashar al-Assad to torture and kill al-Qaeda guys. I'm not saying torture anyone. And I'm not really saying pay Assad. But how in the world can our government go on like it's a sane policy to support any opposition to Bashar al-Assad when Bashar al-Assad is the leading opposition to al-Qaeda in Syria right now? His army is what was keeping al-Qaeda down this whole time. And America's backing them against him. And this continues on.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm very pleased I got Yosef Butt back on the line. He's a nuclear physicist and a writer, and, I can't keep up with your career anymore. Which institute are you at nowadays?
Well, I'm consulting with the British American Security Information Council and also at the Cultural Intelligence Institute in D.C.
Okay, great. And formerly of the Monterey Institute and other famous...
Federation of American Scientists and Union of Concerned Scientists.
Right. Okay, good deal. Yeah, I'm sorry I don't have a up-to-date bio. I should ask you for one here.
No problem.
The great Yosef Butt, everybody, one of my favorite writers on the Iran nuclear beat. And, you know, there are really only, I don't know, 5 or 10 people in North America who really have an interest in writing about this issue all the time. And not all of them are all that good. So anyway, It's really good to have you on and good to talk to you again and good to have the opportunity to get your perspective on things. And I guess we got to start with the big news, which is that the way lines are being drawn, at least in Iraq, I guess we could put Syria to the side for a moment because that's still a confused issue. But at least in Iraq, America is full scale back on the side of Iran and its friends in the Dawa Party government in Baghdad there, like the old days, back in the Badr Brigades against the Sunni-based insurgency. And so I wonder whether you think that that's going to perhaps help the possibility of going ahead and getting this nuclear issue out of the way, or they're perhaps going to be so embarrassed by the fact that the U.S. Army is still fighting for Iran in Iraq that then they'll try to scotch the deal somehow so they don't get along too well. I don't know. What do you think?
It's hard to say. One would hope, the interests, as you say, are aligned in Iraq. The U.S. and Iranian interests are on the same side. So, if there were a nuclear deal, it would help the situation because we could certainly use Iran's help there. So the only problem is, the administration, there's also infighting between the administration and Congress. So, even within the U.S. government, people don't see eye to eye.
Right. Well, now, I guess let me ask you this. Your best understanding, anyway, and I don't mean to try to ask you to be in the mind of the war party necessarily or anything like that, but just from what they've said, from what they're about, what national interest of America's is really threatened by the Iranian regime, if, after all, as we've agreed, because it's a fact, America just fought an 8-year war in Iraq, basically for their interests there, what really is outstanding other than this nuclear deal?
Well, not much. I don't, I'm not really well-versed in all the geopolitics of the region. I'd prefer just to stick to the nuclear issues, but as far as I see it, actually the interests actually are quite aligned between the U.S. and Iran in fighting the Sunni terrorism issue in general. So cooperation on a nuclear deal makes a lot of sense for everyone.
Well, I sure agree with that, too. I can't figure out, I mean, and I'm honestly trying. I can't figure out what the problem is other than this issue. And I think as we're finding out more and more, and as many of us already understood, there never really was much of an issue here in the first place. It makes for a great political fight because it has the word nuclear in it, and that's scary as hell to people, right? But that doesn't mean that there's actually anything to be afraid of here or that there ever was. So I've always been pretty hopeful that if the U.S. government and the Iranian government have the political will to try to come to an agreement, that surely they'll be able to, since they really never wanted more than a nuclear capability anyway, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly right. I think, you know, if you go back into the history, the finding in 2005 that Iran violated its comprehensive safeguards agreement is actually a finding that's sort of a bureaucratic thing, that, you know, some nuclear material was not accounted for. No one has ever said Iran was manufacturing nuclear weapons. You know, a decade ago, they didn't even have the nuclear material to do that. So they, even if they wanted to, they couldn't have been doing it. So, you know, it was a bureaucratic issue of mostly of this material, nuclear material accountancy error. There were a couple of other issues where Iran was found in noncompliance, but, you know, nothing that serious. So, and those issues, in fact, were resolved in 2008. So, you know, the entire situation has been politicized and made scary, as you say, unnecessarily. Mm. Everything could have been resolved in 2008, but, you know, you had these UN Security Council resolutions, which, in fact, in my opinion, were very unorthodox legal application of these sanctions, because they're only supposed to apply in a finding of a threat to the peace, so where one nation is about to attack another nation or has attacked another nation, not about a material accountancy error in the safeguards agreement. So it's been inflated up since the very beginning, and it hasn't been deflated when it should have been in 2008. And we're just, you know, it's been spun up by the media. And I think you're one of the few folks who are still fighting the good fight out there.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I can totally see the perspective that if the media has been saying that this is a really problem for this long and they never really correct it, well, then it must really be a problem for this long, or else, you know, people just assume that there's a check and balance in the media market somewhere, that there's a, you know, some kind of accountability, even if they screw up for a while. And it just sort of seems, it's just the consensus that everybody knows what a terrible problem this is because they never heard anyone say otherwise before. And that becomes the real problem, is just the impression that everybody's under, which becomes all they need to know. But it's funny because when you go back and look at the pieces, like you're saying about an accounting error here about, you know, however many grams of missing material at one point based on paperwork, or like Gareth Porter writes about in his book about a balancing machine and some magnets that are some dual use items that could be used. And what happens is just like with the run up to the Iraq war, is you have basically these data points become talking points, and then each talking point becomes embellished and embellished. And by the time you have, you know, 10 talking points times 10, holy crap, it's a pretty fearful case for what a terrible danger we're all in. But the truth of the matter and the actual science and the measurements and the reality got lost way behind the narrative. And so here we are. Hey, if it's 2014 and they don't have nukes yet, I'm pretty sure they never were making them, Yosef, or else we'd all been blowed up a long time ago, right?
Yeah, you know, again, as I said, I think what the actual findings are and how it's spun up in the media are vastly different. Part of the problem, of course, is many in the non-proliferation community, the experts or so-called experts, also play into this narrative. And, you know, some of them, honestly, some of them for various other reasons, I think a bunch of them honestly want to have a much stronger non-proliferation outlook. And, you know, I call them the maximalists. So, you know, which is fine, but that's just your opinion. You know, it's just their opinion. The international law as it's written, as it's codified, is actually very lenient. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality. And, you know, can Iran cheat? You know, any country can cheat. Yeah. So, you know, it's difficult to focus on just one nation in there for that reason.
Right. All right, everybody. When we get back, we'll talk more about Iran's nuclear program and the possibility of a quote-unquote final deal here and what that might entail. I'm trying to be optimistic about it. It's Yosef Butt. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Yosef Butt. He's a nuclear physicist and a writer on the Iran nuclear issue, as you will see if you Google. And so we're talking about the Iran nuclear deal. Right now, it's the in-between time. We had the interim deal signed last November, and now they're still negotiating kind of all the way through. All reports about the implementation of the interim deal are that that implementation has gone swimmingly on the Iranian side, I believe. Correct, Yosef?
Yeah, that's right.
And what all does that entail, briefly, by the way? I mean, not what all, but as much as you know off the top of your head.
You know, they are stopped their 20% enrichment. They've converted a bunch of the uranium hexafluoride gas into that was enriched to 20% into an oxide form, which is a metal form. So these centrifuges run on gas. So if you want to further enrich above 20%, you need it in a gaseous form. Once you've converted it into a metal or metal oxide form, it becomes kind of a pain to, you know, you have to reconvert it into gas to try to carry forth the conversion. So they've done various things to, you know, everything that was asked of them, basically, to add credence to the fact that they were acting in good faith. So the IAEA has signed off on that, and even the U.S. and the other nations that are negotiating with Iran have all said that the interim measures Iran is living up to, and even some of them exceeding. By that, I mean doing it quicker than they had asked Iran to do. So that... yeah, that interim agreement now ends on July 20th. And so what we're seeing now is the negotiating that's required to have what's called a comprehensive deal after that date.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, so the things that you're describing there basically revolves around the concept of the breakout. And I guess it's sort of like a shade of blue, right? There's no exact definition of a breakout, or you can try to estimate a time on breakout, and that would be the time that they go from saying, aha, we're going to try to make nukes real fast now and kick the inspectors out, to the time that they have a nuke made, I guess a single one, that they want to basically, the Americans or the Western goal here is to lengthen that time to whatever they think is an acceptable breakout period. And the activities that you're describing here, where they're going ahead and converting their uranium hexafluoride gas to a metal and that kind of thing, this is basically along those lines, lengthening that breakout time and going along with the West's demand that it should be harder and harder and harder for them to possibly be able to make a nuclear weapon, I guess. to give the Navy time to prepare airstrikes or whatever, if they were to ever begin to try to make one.
So, and it's actually even, let's say it's the time required to get the material that would be needed to make, you know, the very raw material, not taking into account the time that all the designing and fusing and electronics and...
Well, that makes it an even more meaningless term, doesn't it?
Well,
it just means 90% uranium in their hand?
Yeah, exactly. 80 to 90% enriched uranium in amass the amount of material that's needed for a single nuke. But a single nuke is much more than just the material. So, I mean, that's one part of it. You know, of course, so that's the uranium pathway to make nuclear weapons. There's also a plutonium pathway to make nuclear weapons, and that's the Arak facility that also concerns the West and the nations negotiating with Iran. And just today, Iran announced that it made another good faith move in saying that they would redesign that facility so that it makes much, much less plutonium. And so this redesign at Arak is another positive move from Iran just announced today.
And that seems like a real reassuring move, because that thing, isn't it designed to already produce, or I'm confusing it with Bushehr. Bushehr is the light water reactor that produces the plutonium that's so polluted you can't really use it. It's Iraq really would produce weapons-grade plutonium, but then they would still need a whole new facility to reprocess it, and they would not be able to even harvest the plutonium out of the Iraq facility without everyone in the whole wide world knowing anyway, right?
Yeah, well, you know, you could make a covert facility, I suppose, but it's, as you say, they would need an extra facility to do that, even at Iraq. So, you know, but if they're going to this trouble of redesigning it, it's really not, you know, it's showing you that they're going in the other direction. They're not really going in that way. Again, people now, even it's interesting, even within the non-proliferation community, there's beginning to be disagreements, because the U.S. negotiating position and several think tanks have advocated this idea of breakout being the holy grail, that we should lengthen the time. But in a foreign policy article, Jeffrey Lewis of the Monterey Institute, where I was formerly, just heavily criticized, saying that it's a dead wrong move to obsess over breakout, because, you know, in his mind, you know, if they really wanted to break out, they could do it in a covert way. So then, you know, this other group is saying, well, we need much more intrusive inspections, and don't, you know, negotiate for that. Don't negotiate for breakout. So people don't know what they're doing, basically, because they're all acting outside of the law. I don't mean illegally, but extrajudicially. There's no legal framework to guide the non-proliferation community, so they're just making things up as they can and trying to extract as many concessions from Iran. But
wait a minute. I mean, wasn't it always part of the understanding that they would probably, at least if they didn't outright sign the additional protocol again, that they would have an agreement along those lines with expanded inspection and verification? That would be part of this anyway. So I didn't understand what was his point there, other than just to make sure they don't forget to include that, as though that was ever a danger, that they were going to not include, and we want more inspections too.
Yeah, I think they want things even above the addition protocol. Let's put it that way.
I think that's what they expect to get, concessions beyond the additional protocol too. Yeah. So, yeah, I wonder about that. It seems like kind of a strange, it's almost a Donald Rumsfeldian standard that, you know, there always could be a boulder somewhere that has a secret hatch to a secret uranium enrichment facility that nobody knows about. So I guess, you know, we never can trust or verify what they're not up to.
Exactly. So, you know, there has to be reasonable limits, and those reasonable limits have been codified in the additional protocol for the community. And that's what in my opinion, people should be aiming for. In my view, you know, I think a point that's lost in the media coverage on this is the we don't even know the term, how long the duration of this comprehensive deal. Iran wants it to last about 3 years. The numbers Washington insiders are throwing around are from 5 to 20 years. So, you know, I don't think Iran will ever agree to it because these things go way beyond the normal intrusiveness of inspections. Everything that's being negotiated now goes way beyond. So it's never going to last forever.
And it also would mean it would take that long for our side to lift the sanctions, right?
I'm not sure about that. I think if they, that's something I'm not sure. I think they could start to lift the sanctions if they see Iran agreeing to all those terms. But my point was, I think a smarter thing all around would have been, or could be if people start paying attention, would be to agree to a permanent deal, but to agree to a permanent deal that centers around existing non-proliferation laws. So you could just say, well, you know, we'll force Iran or we'll get Iran to voluntarily comply with the additional protocol forever, instead of saying, well, we're going to reduce their, you know, centrifuges to 500 in number and we're going to make them do all these things, but for 5 years. That's like, okay, then we have the same problem. We're going to have the same negotiating problem in 5 or 10 years, you know. Right. So what's the point? It makes much more sense to go towards something that already exists, but to make it permanent.
Right. Thank you so much for your time. There's the music. Sorry we're out right. of it. But great Thank to you. Talk to you again. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Sure, absolutely. Bye-bye.
Okay, y'all, that's Yosef Butt, formerly with the Federation for American Scientists and the Monterey Institute, and now I forgot what, but anyway, he's a nuclear physicist and writes about Iran nuclear issues, and you'll enjoy reading him, so go look him up. We'll be right back.
The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and back in my day, we weren't at war all over the whole world, all the time. And back in my day, we didn't have government cameras on every street corner. Back in my day, we didn't use a NSA-tracked smart card for our every single purchase, which logs our location everywhere we go. And back in my day, things were bad, but not like this. And anyway, I'm feeling old. I got a lot of gray hairs on my chin, I admit. But things are changing so fast now that it's almost like my childhood was all in black and white film or something in the 1980s compared to the way things are. And that's sort of the theme of this great article by William Astor and Tom Englehart. It ran at tomdispatch.com, and now it's at antiwar.com. Drafted by the National Security State, the militarized realities of Fortress America. Welcome back to the show, William. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Scott. Yeah, those were the good old days, right? You know, no cameras everywhere. You know, it does seem like, you know, I grew up in the 70s instead of the 80s, but it's been amazing to me, as you know from reading the article, how militarized we've become in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, well, it's really something else. And the thing of it is, too, at the root of it all, I guess, or a major part of it, is that the lowliest private is our highest idol. And so to criticize the foreign policy at all, I mean, even if you're not really feeling it, you're just not supposed to come out against it. Because to come out against it is to betray and stab that young private in the back. And so, you know, it's all reinforced by everyone having to stop and clap at the airport and all this kind of thing. Where if the lowest military man is our highest, you know,
part in society, most respected member of society, then what does that make everybody above him in rank, and what does that make the rest of us? You know, it changes the whole balance of everything, because otherwise you're spitting on the guys like when they came home from Vietnam, right? It's that black and white of an issue. Those are your two choices.
Right, right. And of course, as you know, most of that spitting that occurred on the Vietnam veterans is more legend than reality. But you're absolutely right. You know, I mentioned in my article that when I joined ROTC in 1981, you know, I was walking the streets of Worcester, Massachusetts in my uniform. And, you know, everyone wasn't clapping me on the back, telling me I was a hero. You know, this was right after the Vietnam War. You had movies like Coming Home and Apocalypse Now. And people were more skeptical of the military, as well we should be. I mean, that's part of American history. Our history for the first 200 years or so was that, you know, we didn't really want a large standing military. We were distrustful of that. But, of course, after World War II, and then particularly with in the Reagan years, with the Reagan buildup, and then the whole myth that we won the Cold War, you know, primarily through military might. You know, that whole idea has supported now, you know, now everyone to the lowliest private is a hero just for putting on a uniform.
Right, yeah. And it just legitimizes the whole thing. Even, you know, I remember Pat Buchanan, who absolutely opposed both Iraq wars. Once the war started, in the spring of 2003, he said, now everyone who opposes it has to shut up and not oppose it anymore, because otherwise it's just so ingrained in all of us.
Right.
And after all, they are risking their lives under the assumption anyway, most of them, that, you know, the rest of the adults in the democracy figured out whether this was worth it or not back before.
That's
absolutely
right.
And so they're only
right.
doing what's the right thing to do, right?
that's
what the
know,
green uniform means, is that the democracy said that this is okay.
Exactly. And part of it as well is that our foreign policy, as you know, Scott, it is a foreign policy that's now pretty much run by the military. I mean, the Pentagon and the Defense Department dwarfs the State Department. So you really can't criticize our country's foreign policy because it's our foreign policy is implemented by the military, by those privates and corporals and airmen and sailors. And so, you know, and those are the ones we are supposed to support without question. This mantra of support our troops, you know, it's not a bad idea. Like you said, you know, they a lot of them did volunteer. A lot of them are working class, lower middle class. They signed up for the military in many cases because they just wanted a decent salary and health care. But some of them are motivated by patriotism. And so, you know, there's a lot of societal pressure put on us, as well as the reality that our young people are looking to serve our country. It's unfortunate that in many cases they're being put to, you know, being sent to wars, being sent to Afghanistan and Iraq, into places where they really can't make a difference for, you know, to find non-existent weapons of mass destruction.
Right. I think this is something that, you know, we hear this from a lot of vets, but the most obvious cases are our whistleblowers. Snowden, although he did wash out of basic training with broken legs, but still he told the same story, you know, volunteered for the Army. And then after discharge, you know, being washed out of the Army, he went to join the CIA and the NSA, believing in the mission. Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning had basically the same story. Sergeant Bergdahl, not so much the whistleblower, but recently in the news here. These guys all have as a shared narrative that they believed in this stuff. And then they
sure.
got there, or then they, you know, waited around and saw how it was actually playing out. I think Snowden talks about he saw the CIA blackmail a Swiss banker who hadn't done anything to anyone, but they just were going to ruin his life in order to get at this other guy kind of thing. And he just thought, well, that's not fair play. And you know, Manning, of course, was ordered to participate in the kidnapping and torture of dissidents against Nouri al-Maliki and this kind of thing. And so what happens is there's this... There's a lifetime of commercials viewed during football games where all this is just great and perfectly acceptable, and it's the consensus that it's all great and perfectly acceptable, and yes, we're going to help these people, whatever. And then they get there, they have a little bit of experience with it, and you know, people react in different ways about it. The moral injury, as it's called, when they realize that it's just not true. They're in fact involved in an entirely different mission. So
right. Well,
seems to me completely understandable. In fact, that has happened from the very beginning. That was Pat Tillman's story. Was he started reading Noam Chomsky and stuff. He was going to come home and be an anti-war activist.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a shame what happened to Pat Tillman. And the cover-up, you know, the cover-up of that friendly fire incident, you know, it just really was a black mark against the Army, you know, the way that what was covered up. I mean, you know, for a military man like myself, you know, military, we're supposed to be about integrity. And to see that kind of betrayal, you know, not only the friendly fire incident, but then the lying to the parents and trying to paper over that crime by giving Pat Tillman a Silver Star. I mean, that was just a horrendous miss. You know, it was a betrayal of trust by the Army, sadly.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems kind of the marker of a good marker of the beginning of this era, where basically the whole thing is a giant waste. At best, it's a waste. It's, you know, really, you look at it, especially this week, you can't really call it a wash or anything. It's net negatives for pretty much everybody involved.
Yeah, I mean, what's really disappointing is that, you know, we obviously sent you know, hundreds of thousands of troops to Iraq. Many of them were trying to do, you know, a decent job. They're trying to do the best they knew how. And yet now you have the events unfolding in Iraq where, you know, all those American efforts to try to build an Iraqi army, you know, and the billions of dollars that we spent trying to do that just seems to be, you know, money that was just, you know, just no results. Just wasted.
Yeah, well, 30,000 of them turned and fled when 800 men came with pickup trucks.
Well, you know, it's easy to create an army and to give them weapons, but an army needs a cause. They need something to believe in, or mm-hmm. they won't fight.
Exactly.
And that seems to be something that a lesson we can't learn.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with William J. Astor, retired Lieutenant Colonel of the Air Force, and Tom Dispatch Regular. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Hillary Mann Leverett coming up in the next segment to talk with us about the war in Syria and Iraq. Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani issuing a call to arms. Highest ranking Shiite cleric in the world there. So chapter 3 or 4 or 5 or whichever you call it is just getting cranked up now, I'm afraid. Hillary Mann Leverett in just a little while. Right now, we're talking with William Astor. I'm sorry, William, I forgot how to say your last name right. Will you help me so I stop screwing it up, at least for today?
It is a story.
A story, okay. Thank you, and sorry. Okay, so he writes, he's a Air Force officer, retired Air Force officer. He writes great anti-war stuff for Tom Dispatch. That's tomdispatch.com, Tom Englehart, of course. And we rerun pretty much all of Tom's stuff at antiwar.com under his name. And this one is in the viewpoint section today at antiwar.com. It's called Drafted by the National Security State. It's about how, since the end of the draft and the creation of the so-called professional military, you say that really the entire society has been conscripted. This militarism has been built into the rest of society sort of as a consequence of the end of the draft and the beginning of the professionalization of it. How exactly does that work?
Yeah, it's been a subtle process. I don't think it didn't start right away. You know, after the Vietnam War, there was a time when America was more critical of the military. But I think beginning in the 1980s, beginning with Ronald Reagan, and then the defense buildup, the winning of the Cold War, and then, of course, you recall, Scott, the idea that after the Cold War, we were going to be cashing in the peace dividend. You know, we wouldn't have to have a large military. And I think that was a crucial point right there, when that did not happen. And instead, we got involved with the first Iraq War. And then, of course, the biggest thing of all was the attack on 9/11. After 9/11, with Bush and Cheney, obviously, the whole idea became, we as a society must support our military, you must support the troops, which is another way of saying that when we send the troops into harm's way, you can't criticize our foreign policy because you're stabbing the troops in the back, which is exactly what you said earlier. It's very clever, very subtle. And at the same time, as you know, we've been building up our police forces. We've been arming them with, of all things, those mine resistant, those anti-mine MRAP vehicles, so that now your local police force might not only have automatic weapons, but tanks designed for the Iraqi battlefield. All kinds of signs like that. More and more movies coming out that are pro-military. Video games like Call of Duty, which are also, pro-military. Recruitment vans showing up. I lived in Pennsylvania for a time. Air Force recruiting van showing up at the Little League World Series with video games to entice the kids into the back of these vans so that they play the video games at the same time, feel good about the Air Force so that, maybe in 6 years they sign up. So all of these things have been going on.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things, and I don't know if it's even really like this anymore, but especially in the 1990s, I know on the Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel, all the time it was always just the hardware of war, where if you're a red-blooded American male, check out this kick-ass fighter jet, and just
never
even mind anything about who they might be killing. I mean, it just completely goes without saying how perfectly legitimate all this is. Whatever the cost of this aircraft carrier we're showing you, whatever the cost of any of this stuff, of course it's all perfectly justified, but man, wouldn't you like to go Mach 3? Me too, dude.
Yeah, it's the pornography of violence, really. And part of that was the whole Top, I guess that got started with Top Gun, with Tom Cruise, the Iron Eagle movies, all these movies that basically glorify military hardware. And what you never see, obviously, or rarely see on the American press, is any kind of depiction of the results of the use of these weapons. You never see dead bodies. I mean, you remember when, under Bush and Cheney, that they wouldn't even show American caskets, flag-draped caskets, coming home. You know, they forbade the images of those. It's like it's this antiseptic version of war. It's unfortunately, war reduced to a video game, which is another way of glorifying it as something fun.
Right. Well, and the problem with that too, especially the video game thing there, is that as that becomes more and more of a reality with the drone wars around the world, is that U.S. government spreads its enemies around the world with its drones, basically. It also, it seems like, creates a real problem for us, maybe for more the long term, if we get used to thinking that that's perfectly, a perfectly legitimate way to fight a war, just flying remote control planes around bombing people on the ground who can't possibly shoot back, and ignoring completely how that looks to everyone else in the world. Oh, I see. You guys have fancy remote control planes that even if we could hit them, you don't even have a pilot in them. While we've got, you know, World War One rifles or where that's a not that war is supposed to be a fair fight necessarily, but that sort of seems like the very poorest sportsmanship in world history in a way kind of thing. And it seems like it really blackens the definition of what America means to the rest of the world, especially those particular victims, and really in the minds of the American people, too, about who we are and what we're about after all of this, and after not rolling it back after all of this.
Absolutely. You end up with the corruption of the American soul, or at least the compromise of American principles. I mean, I think of, you know, I'm a big fan of the Godfather movies. You know, I think of Michael Corleone, you know, trying to kill all of his enemies, you know, so much so that he eventually kills his own brother, Fredo. I mean, this is not the way to solve your problems, is going around and, you know, and killing everyone. And even the Godfather and the Mafia realize that if you do this, you end up just corrupting your very existence.
Right. Well, and it may be too late now. You know, I keep thinking about, you know, how obvious the anti-war message is at this point and how right it is. And then I turn on TV and just like any time there's a crisis, immediately they just turn to the generals and to the same old talking heads and the same old people who are going to recommend the same old bombing campaigns. And there's just, we're just going to keep on like this. Nobody with any power or influence is ever held accountable in media or in politics. And so we just keep rolling on.
Well, we have to keep fighting, and that's what you kind of do on your show. At least you offer alternative viewpoints.
Well, I'm sure trying. I sure appreciate you helping me out. It's William Astori, everybody. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
Find him today at antiwar.com, also at tomdispatch.com. We'll be right back with Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show. ScottHorton.org is my website where I keep all my archives. LRN.FM is the website of the Liberty Radio Network, where I'm live from noon to 3 Eastern Time weekdays. And just a couple of headlines here real quick. Iraq's top Shiite cleric, Ali al-Sistani, calls out the militias. Iranian commander, quote, in charge in Baghdad fight. Iran deploys troops to Baghdad to fight against al-Qaeda. U.S. readies airstrikes against al-Qaeda in Iraq. Obama says won't send troops. All right, and now introducing Hillary Mann Leverett. She is formerly of the State Department, the National Security Council, and the U.S. mission to the United Nations. She's the co-author with her husband, Flint Leverett, of the book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And she writes at her website, Going to Tehran. And their article, their brand new one, Don't Double Down in Syria, is published today at antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Hillary?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you showing up today. And so... Well, can we just start with the top headline there? Ali al-Sistani, the highest-ranking Shiite religious authority in the world. You know, I think I paid pretty close attention. I don't know if I remember him ever directly calling men to arms during the entire time of the Iraq War. Do you know about that? Is that unprecedented?
It may be. During the U.S. occupation of Iraq, there were a range of Shia militias that were very active in the south in terms to control their own territory, to defend against, in their perception, defend against the United States. So there may not have been as much of a need as there is today. But Ayatollah Sistani is his message is being done, I think, very much in coordination with the existing Shia militias that are also clearly mobilized and saying so publicly.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I guess I really am with today's headlines. I'm getting ahead of the narrative here. We've got this. Well, the rise of, it's been characterized on this show by other experts previously this week, Mitchell Prothero of McClatchy Newspapers, Patrick Coburn, Dar Jamil, that the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria or the Sham or whatever you call it, is really no longer a group with a name way bigger than their real presence like it was all along. I think it used to be a joke. They called themselves the Islamic State when they were just a ragtag group of nobodies. Seems like actually they have a state now, that this is actually the name of a place now. Is that your take on the situation? Is it too soon to really say that?
It may be too soon, but clearly their fortunes have risen dramatically. If you look back to just 4 years ago in 2010, they were very much on the ropes. They were an organization that had very little funding, very little arms, very little impact. And then we have the outbreak of protest, violence, however you characterize it, in Damascus, around Damascus in Syria, of course, and a huge infusion of weapons, money, and support from, particularly from our partners in the on the Arab side of the Gulf, from President Obama himself saying Assad has to go, and from our European partners. And they have taken off ever since then. There is a tendency in Washington to, in a sense, characterize the takeoff of ISIS in 2011 as connected to the troop withdrawal, that, well, we shouldn't have withdrawn troops, and this is part of, I think, the argument building to increase America's involvement. But that really misses the on-the-ground reality. It had nothing to do with the combat troops being taken out of, U.S. combat troops being taken out of Iraq. It had very much to do with the infusion of arms, cash, training, support onto the Syrian side of really what is a no-man's land between Syria and Iraq, and thousands of these fighters going from Iraq to Syria, becoming battle-trained, battle-hardened, and now, you know, shock of shocks, 3 years later, they're back in Iraq in a much fuller, ferocious force.
Hmm. Well, you know, it's just amazing to me the way, well, it's pretty clear that, you know, the TV anchors are mostly just sort of news actors. So they don't really know what to do with their confusion. They sort of skate on past it. But some of the more informed TV experts are having a lot of trouble ducking around the fact that they are still, to this moment, and including the president today in his statement on the White House lawn, and everyone in both parties, I guess, still on this mantra that we've got to double down our support for the rebels in Syria. At the same time, they're freaking out about this crisis in Iraq, and we're just supposed to take for granted that it's true, even though everyone knew it wasn't true back when Kerry told John McCain in Senate testimony last summer that, oh yeah, no, the supermajority of the rebels in Syria are, you know, moderate and secular. And everybody thought that was a ridiculous joke. Everybody knows better than that. Everybody knows that that's not true. And, you know, Mitchell Prothero was on the show, like I said, from McClatchy, and he said there are moderates, the FSA fighters, who aren't Islamist bin Ladenites, but there's not that many of them, and they don't do that much fighting. And, you know, basically they're just criminals and gangsters and hustlers rather than real fighters of any kind anyway. So the war really does belong to these jihadists. Even the New York Times, Hillary all along, and their representative, I think, of the rest of the media, they've reported from time to time that all the weapons and money are going to the kooks. If not ISIS, then al-Nusra, which I guess supposedly is less brutal but more loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri out of the two. And yet, still, you know, they just played on MSNBC this morning, Hillary Clinton saying, yes, I tried to get Obama to support the rebels even more. And Obama saying, yeah, now we got to support the rebels even more because of this crisis. Am I the only one whose head is exploding here? Is this narrative ever going to work itself out? And actually, here's the real question. If they stop putting Israel first and their hatred of Bashar al-Assad and Hezbollah and Iran first, because that's what Israel wants, and they actually get a coherent narrative here, like there's the rise of a proto-Al-Qaeda state here, then won't that mean a real war?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't think you're the only one whose head is exploding. And in fact, this whole, I think you could encapsulate what's going on now from something that Albert Einstein said decades ago when he defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over again that fails, but thinking it's going to turn out differently. We have been funding, arming, and training extreme militias for some time, whether it's the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, whether it's these people in Libya. The story that is also underreported are all of the American weapons that we sent directly and indirectly through our so-called friends, the Saudis and the Qataris, to Libya have been seized by Libyan extremist militias and are being used today to wreak havoc over Libya. So, you know, that's exactly what former Secretary Clinton and President Obama are asking the American people to do again, is to support a strategy that has failed repeatedly, and to do so in one of the most dangerous places on earth with one of the most dangerous organizations, an organization that is so brutal that Al-Qaeda even disowned it, this Islamic State of Iraq and Syria group. So, yes, to somehow pour more weapons in, like we did to Iraq, we poured $14 billion worth of hardware into Iraq, which today, they're not just, the ISIS is not just seizing that material, Iraqi soldiers are handing it to them. Those are the so-called moderates. The same thing, you know, has happened and will continue to happen in Syria. Any weapons that go to the so-called moderates are handed over to those who can fight better, which in this, you know, in their context is Jabhat al-Nusra and its parent organization, ISIS.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Long War Journal just had a thing a couple of weeks ago where the TOW missiles, the sophisticated anti-tank missiles that they're giving them, the same ones that Ronald Reagan had the Israelis sell Khomeini back in the 80s, those TOW missiles are immediately, they've gone from the so-called Islamic Front to al-Nusra, you know, in a matter of weeks. Just the same thing over and over again this whole time. As you said, insanity continued. All right, well, the music's playing, so we got to go, but we'll be right back in just a moment with Hillary Mann Leverett, co-author of this great new piece at antiwar.com today, Don't Double Down in Syria. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Talking with Hillary Mann Leverett from goingtotehran.com. That's the book, too. Read it. You know, as mentioned, Reagan selling, having the Israelis sell TOW missiles to Iran in exchange for some hostages back in the 1980s. I was thinking during the commercial break, Hillary, that, boy, things were really simple back then, arming both sides of that war against each other, Saddam and the Iranians, too. Obviously, Saddam much more than the Iranians. But here in this case, America's on all sides of this thing in every kind of way. And it just seems like I can't, if there's another explanation, I sure would like to hear it. But it seems to me like this has got to just be all about Israel. There's no other explanation for why America is not working with Iran and especially with Syria, with the Baathist Shiite majority coalition secularist dictatorship of Syria to kill these al-Qaeda guys. George Bush paid Assad to kill these guys. George Bush paid Assad to torture these guys. And I'm not saying that's good, but I'm saying at least it makes sense. It's a coherent narrative if we just fought a war for the Shiites, a war which, by the way, the Saudis were funding our guys' enemies, the Sunni insurgency, the whole time, just like they're now we're on their side funding these guys again inside Syria right now. Obviously, it's kind of a confusing mess, but it just, I don't understand what's going on here. And again, I think actually the war parties putting Israel first is actually help preventing a war here because it's keeping the narrative confused. If it wasn't for the especially the Republicans' determination to make Assad the root bad guy of everything right now, then the narrative would be much simpler that al-Qaeda is creating a state on both sides of the border in Syria and Iraq, and we got to go to war against it. So It, in fact, at this point, their treachery is preventing the war from getting worse, I think, maybe, at least for now. I don't know, but explain to me what else it could possibly be as preventing America from just outright backing the Quds Force in their war against ISIS this week in Iraq, for example.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are a couple of things. One is, you know, I think in terms of the Israelis, they certainly had an interest in the United States and others weakening Assad, militarily weakening Assad, to weaken Syria and Syria's military itself vis-a-vis Israel, but also to weaken what they thought could be to weaken Hezbollah in Lebanon and to weaken Iran. They thought, you know, this whole thing would somehow... supporting these militants in Syria would be this trifecta. It would weaken Assad and the Syrian military, it would weaken Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it would weaken Iran. I think what drives U.S. policy, though, is something that we can even take a page out of the Middle East and go back to your Iran-Contra scenario, but to focus for just a second on the Contras. So what we did was we got the Israelis to sell the Iranians TOW missiles to get our hostages out of Lebanon, but then we took that cash that the Iranians gave us, and against the administration did, and against the law, against congressionally passed legislation, gave that money to this brutal death force in Nicaragua, the Contras, to try to overthrow their democratically elected government. Now, the reason for that is I don't think that the United States is just some sort of bloodthirsty, you know, craven crazy. The reason, the driver there is for hegemony, whether it's hegemony as it was with Nicaragua in Latin America, in our hemisphere, or it has been this feudal, catastrophically counterproductive drive for U.S. hegemony in the Middle East. And where Israel comes in is that Israel is, and put itself forward to be, an important implementer of this American drive for hegemony. It's so interesting. You know, there was not any support in the United States for Israel from 1948 to 1968, when, you know, with these arguments about, well, we have this common, sympathy with Israel over the Holocaust. We have this common value with Israel, with their democracy. Wherever people come out on those two issues, you cannot argue that from 1948 to 1968, Israel was less democratic than it is today, where it occupies vastly more Palestinians who have no rights, or that the Holocaust was further from people's minds in the immediate wake of it, right after World War II. The reason why Israel then becomes important by after the 67 war in 1968 is that they demonstrate that they can take territory from Arab states aligned with the Soviet Union, principally Egypt, which was the big independent Arab military power, but also Syria, that Israel could take those strategic territories, and that Israel was willing to and eager to pursue a strategy of using force whenever, wherever, and whatever degree it wanted or could to subordinate its neighbors. The United States latched onto that as a good partnership, as something in the U.S. interest, and has cultivated it ever since, and of course armed it to the teeth. So, you know, it is certainly a double-edged sword in many, many ways, but I think the big result is it leads us to take these decisions, like arming and funding an al-Qaeda offshoot indirectly, at least through what we've given to the Syrian opposition, makes us do these things that seem bizarre because they're part of this really counterproductive pursuit of hegemony and using Israel as a partner in that cause.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the way that it's portrayed by Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, it's much more simple. He says, well, you know, Hezbollah is backed by Syria, is backed by Iran. And so I prefer these bad guys to those bad guys. If you make it that black and white of an issue, Hezbollah is not really an enemy of the United States. Al-Qaeda is. And so sort of it's treason. Where our government is on the wrong side of this fight. There's no other way to put it. It's the same thing happened. I mean, you characterize it how you want back in 2003 when Iran said, hey, we arrested a bunch of al-Qaeda guys fleeing your war in Afghanistan. Let us turn them over to you in exchange for some MEK cultists. And the Bush administration said no.
Right. I mean, the principal problem is that Iran and Hezbollah are not going to subordinate their, you know, their policies, their interests to the United States and Israel. Whereas the Sunnis, a lot of the Sunni states, Egypt, Saudi Arabia in particular, are certainly willing to subordinate their interests, their policymaking, even their sovereignty to the United States, which means that where Al-Qaeda basically comes from, most Al-Qaeda foot soldiers have been Saudi and Egyptian, that we can somehow rely on our friends in the Egyptian government and the Saudi government to sit on them, whereas we can't rely on people in the Iranian government or Hezbollah leadership to sit on, you know, their compatriots. So that's where I think the issue of who's bad guy is worse. It's just that we think that somehow we can sit on, we can get our allies, our so-called allies in Saudi Arabia and Egypt in particular, to sit on these Al-Qaeda folks.
Well, and that just seems completely opposite of reality, right? Where Nasrallah is a conservative, old, stable kind of a force there with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon compared to a bunch of suicide bomber crazies, which Hezbollah's had their suicide bombers in the past, I guess, but compared to these ISIS guys who crucify their enemies in the center of town and, you know, kill people just for being, they call Shiites polytheists. Oh, man, like that's not a declaration of permanent war right there. How can Bandar control Omar al-Baghdadi or whoever's running ISIS right now? How can, just because Saudi might want to do what America says there, these guys sort of seem like the cat let out of the bag to me.
Well, they may want to, and certainly I think the, you know, the ruling party in Egypt and the ruling family in Saudi Arabia do want to and are very much dependent on a security relationship with the United States arming them. They also have to deal with public opinion, public sentiment in their very heavily Islamist societies. So they're constantly walking this tightrope or going right over to the edge on their swords between keeping the United States, supporting them, arming them, and giving some support, certainly not just rhetorical, but at least rhetorical support to really ideologically charged Islamist militants. So it's a constant struggle, I think, for the Egyptian and Saudi leaderships to have to make this balance, and then we are left with the mess. We are left with the raging resentment of these people, particularly in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, who are being ruled by governments that are not representative of them. And the perception is that we're backing those governments up. So it's we've known this for a long time, but we keep doubling down because I think in particular the Egyptian and Saudi governments are willing to support our policies, whether they're in the realm of what we call terrorism or if they're about Israel. Those governments are willing to go along.
Right. All right. Well, we're all out of time. We've got to leave it right there. But thank you very much for your time. Good to talk to you again, Hillary.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's Hillary Mann Leverett. She's the author of the book, co-author of the book, Going to Tehran, Why the U.S. Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And her website is goingtotehran.com. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And you might be saying, wow, Scott, you must be magic. You're always predicting what's going to happen. But no, I'm just paying attention. And I don't really have an agenda other than I hate the government and I think everything it does is completely and totally illegitimate and that it should be completely abolished. And somehow that just gives me extra clarity, you know? I guess. But go back the last couple of weeks. I've been talking with Flint Leverett, Phil Giraldi, Michael Scheuer about the coming war in Iraq and Syria against the new Islamic State coming up there. And then, blam, Islamic State becomes the big news a week later. Right. So now I got these great interviews, Dar Jamail, Patrick Coburn, Mitchell Prothero, now Hillary Mann Leverett, on all these developments all week long. So that's pretty good. That's mostly why I'm smart about this stuff, is I get to ask questions of all the people who write all the great stuff that I read. So that's pretty good, right? First I read their stuff and I think I get it, and then I say, do I get it? Or I say, let's talk about whatever I want, or whatever happens, you know. But there you go. And she's really right. I blame Israel too much. The truth is, the American government, they can't stand the Iranians. They just can't stand them. Doesn't matter how aligned their interests are on Al-Qaeda or anything else, because they maintain independence from the American Empire. They declared independence from the American Empire. And that is absolutely and totally unforgivable. And so, I gotta think that at some point it sank in the Bush years, that we really are fighting this war. I mean, among the guys in the White House and on the National Security Council, we really are fighting this war for Iran right now, but what are we gonna do? Stop now? Gotta get to some kind of equilibrium, you know? And I think they thought for a while they would have a regime change in Iran one way or another, and so it wouldn't matter if they fought a war for Iran and Iraq. But that didn't quite work out. That couldn't possibly work out. But again, we're talking about the Bush administration. Eventually, I mean, ultimately, Bush did not go for it. So that's good. But the truth is, with the so-called surge working, what really happened there was they put, with the extra 30,000 troops, they put the finishing touches on kicking the Sunnis out of Baghdad. So there was a victory there. And that's mostly what led to the relative peace. And, you know, I'm sorry I don't have my footnotes. Usually, on an issue like this, I ought to be able to rattle off all of my footnotes at once. But it really did all come together at one point back, I think, in 2008. Right at the end of the Bush years. The last couple of articles came out that covered every single summer from 2003 all the way through 2006. Every summer, the Sunni imams and former Baathists and tribal leaders had offered the Americans, look, we'll quit being the Sunni-based insurgency against you if you'll just stop warring against us. Let us patrol our own neighborhoods and maybe give us a little money, promise us a role in the new government, and we'll stop fighting. And the Americans said, nah, we'll defeat you, and we'll march. Bush said, we'll kick ass, we'll march to democracy, dirt, dirt, dirt. And went on and refused to accept that. Petraeus' victory was over George Bush. Petraeus' victory was, he said, Mr. President, we're not going to have victory over the Sunni-based insurgency, but we're going to just bribe them, and we're going to go ahead and accept their deal that they've offered year after year after year this entire time, to go ahead and basically call a ceasefire with us on the condition that they will turn against the Zarqawiites. And so George Bush told Petraeus, okay. So, and then they also fought sort of a sub war under the surge against Muqtada al-Sadr. Again, the one nationalist who had wanted to make a coalition Arab government with the Sunnis, they targeted him and killed all of his guys and tried to marginalize him, because he also wanted to kick the Americans out as well as the Iranians out. And so they marginalize him in favor of the guys who are much more pro-Iran. And that was sort of, in a way, it was all just a giant waste. Even in the context of the Iraq war, it was a giant waste when Muqtada al-Sadr ended up having, and still has, a whole hell of a lot of influence among the Shiite Arabs there. But anyway, mostly the surge was a war to finish the civil war, to end the civil war. And then the defeated Sunnis made a deal that they would get to patrol their own neighborhoods if they turned on Al-Qaeda and the Zarqawiites and kept them down. And then under the promise that betray them, General David betray their sorry asses, made to them that you will become part of the Iraqi army. And you will become part of the Iraqi police. You will become part of the Iraqi government. You will have a say in the Iraqi democracy and all of this stuff. Those were the benchmarks of the surge. It wasn't supposed to just be a military victory for Baghdad. It was supposed to be power-sharing agreement where, yeah, the Shiites won the elections, but instead of winner-take-all, they're supposed to kind of, you know, cooperate in a little democracy sense. It's supposed to mean a little more than majority rule. Nope. And, of course, Maliki and his government never lived up to that because Maliki and his government were, again, not like the Sadrists. The Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, they put Iran first. And that was why they always supported, quote, strong federalism. In other words, they were willing to give up the Anbar province and the Sunni provinces. They never really imagined that they could really, you know, conquer and control those areas. And so now all that's just come to fruition. So in other words, what's happening now, never mind that it's ISIS that are flying the black banners now, the fact that the Sunni areas of Iraq are wholly basically going along with this, city after city, and declaring independence from Baghdad is just basically the announcement that's overdue since 2008, 2009, that the partition of the country is over. And they're now declaring independence. Now, that should mean, possibly, that the civil war is still over. The Sunni, the ISIS guys especially, they'd be crazy to think that they can take Baghdad. Because the U.S. Army and Marine Corps gave Baghdad to the Shiites. Not just to the Shiite army of the Badr Brigade, but to the Shiite population. And the Sunnis were all kicked out. It was called sectarian cleansing. They always have some fancy jargon for they were all terrorized right the hell out of their homes and out of the capital city. In fact, if you look in Justin Raimondo's article today, you'll find a link in there to a population map of Iraq as it gets more and more and more Shia over the years from 2003 through 2008, where by the end of the war, 2009, it's 85% Shiite city. So in other words, when Ali al-Sistani, never even mind Muqtada al-Sadr, is calling out the Mahdi army, Ali al-Sistani, the highest-ranking Shiite cleric in the world, is calling out every Shia with a rifle to come out and protect the Shiite shrines, to protect Najaf, to protect Karbala and the Shiite mosque in Samarra and all this. Well, they'll be able to keep them out of Baghdad anyway. And I think the ISIS guys would be crazy to try to take Baghdad. That war is lost. They lost that civil war. But on the other hand, the guys who won it, they don't have the ability to take the Anbar province. They don't have the ability to take Mosul back. They don't have the ability to reconquer Fallujah. They don't have the ability to take any of the predominantly Sunni areas of Iraq either. The civil war is over. The Declaration of Independence has been filed, and they're separate. If they keep fighting over Baghdad, I guess, you know, it's better than them coming west. For my purposes and yours, but it would be a stupid fight, and I don't expect them to fight that hard for it. I'm sure there'll be some attacks, and there's a lot of hatred. And you know what? I guess it depends on how much Saudi money they got and how much money they seized from that central bank in Mosul. How much of a fight they can put up with. But it took the American army to kick all the Sunnis out. It's going to take a hell of a lot more Al-Qaeda to kick all the Shia out of Baghdad. This battle's about to turn around and go back to Syria, is my guess. Admit it, our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's funny to me watching news coverage of this Iraq thing. And it's not just the TV hairdos, but actually even some of the reporters. The TV news hairdos, too. I mean, they are humans, right? Kinda, if you think about them that way. The news anchors. They've never told the truth to the American people about who's who in Iraq before. I saw it sink through a MSNBC news anchor's, you know, makeup layer and through her thick skull today, and she says, and Iran is against Al-Qaeda in this one. Couldn't bring herself to say America's on the side of Iran in this one. Just like Chuck Todd can't bring himself to say America's on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria. And they don't know what to do with all this information. They just don't know what to do about it. Because, just wait a minute, even if you're a news anchor, if we and Iran and the Maliki government are all working together, and it's a big Shiite government there, and the Shiite majority of the Iraq, blah, 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 now, and we're all working together against Al-Qaeda now, well then, doesn't that imply that the American war for the Shia was for Iran and Iran's friends that whole time, right? Al-Qaeda in Iraq was the enemy from the Iraq war, remember that? So the whole war was for Iran the whole time, right? And yet, on MSNBC news anchor lady's face comes this twist. Huh? She can't quite get it straight. It's like when John McCain, you can find the YouTube of this, it's actually pretty funny. John McCain is on a junket over there to Iraq back in, say, 2007. And he says, you know, Iran, this was back when they were lying and pretending that Iran was behind the insurgency against the U.S. But the insurgency against the U.S. was the Al-Qaeda insurgency. And it made no sense whatsoever that Iran was behind the Al-Qaeda insurgency. They just never addressed that. But McCain's problem was, is he took the argument ad absurdum and ran with it and said, you know, Al-Qaeda is going to Iran to train to attack our guys. And when he said the obvious lie, that obviously, Joe Lieberman had to come and whisper in his ear, oh, actually it's militants that are going to train in Iran. Because see, if you lie so obviously, and you say that Al-Qaeda in Iraq fighting the defensive rearguard action against the Iranian-backed Shiites that America's also backing, too many people aren't going to buy it. So we're going with militants. Yeah, Iran is training militants. Yeah, they're training our guys. That was our whole war, was to make the Badr Brigade the Iraqi army. That's why when Al-Qaeda sacks a couple of Sunni-based, Sunni-majority cities in the north and west of the country, we read that the Iranians are coming to help the Iraqi government, the Iraqi democracy. But on TV, they go, huh? And you know why they go, huh? Because the whole time during that Iraq war, they never explained who's who. They never explained. For almost a decade, they talked about the Iraqi people as though the fight was not between the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army on one side and the Sunni-based insurgency with their Al-Qaeda friends on the other side. And the Peshmergas, the Kurdish Peshmergas fighting with the Shiites in the Iraqi army and as auxiliaries to the Iraqi army. As though the El Salvador option was just, well, you know, sort of getting a special forces group to go after the insurgents. No, it was getting the worst torturers of the Badr Brigade to go after the leaders of the Sunni-based insurgency. Yeah, so, anyway, they never told the truth in all those years of Iraq war coverage. Yeah, so there's the Americans, and then there's the good guys, the poor little Iraqi people who we love so much who we're doing this for, and then there's the bad guys who would dare to try to thwart us. And they never explained who was who. They never explained. And so now, huh, I guess Iran is against Al-Qaeda, huh? Say the most knowledgeable people on cable TV whose job it is to tell us what the truth is. And they don't know the first thing about it. They're learning this shit today. They're learning today about this. In case you're hearing this on MP3 later, it's June the 13th, 2014, as I shriek. It's impossible to me. It's just incredible to me. Hillary and Obama. Obama, the president, today on the White House lawn, saying he wants to expand support for the rebels in Syria as a response to the fact that ISIS are the rebels in Syria. Oh no, he wants to support different rebels in Syria that'll somehow thwart ISIS. Which, as Hillary Mann Leverett was just explaining, is what they've been trying to do for years and hasn't worked. The guns and the weapons and the money just go to ISIS because they're the ones who are the badasses, because they're the ones who aren't afraid to die. They're the ones who are the committed soldiers out there blowing themselves up and cutting little kids' heads off and waging holy war against the polytheists or whatever the crap that they believe in. They're the ones with the weapons and the money because they're the ones who take the weapons and the money because they're the ones who are the true believers in the cause. A bunch of moderates sit on their CIA-paid fat asses in a hotel talking about, you know, what overthrowing they're doing. The president of the United States today. Hell, let me find it in the YouTube. I'll find the damn thing. Nah, I won't. I couldn't cue it up live on the air. I guess I could during the break. No, but he said it, though. I have it here somewhere, man. Wait, here's part of it. No, this is a quote, but I don't have enough of it. At the Huffington Post here, they had some of the quotes. They're a vicious organization, he describes them as. But then he says, "But so we got to double down our support for the rebels. Not... hey, listen, we're reluctantly going back to the Bush policy of backing Assad against these guys, because what the hell, we got to keep them out of Europe, don't we? And I'm not saying that that's my position, but I'm just saying if our government was anything like the security force of the American people, that would be their priority. Or, you know, really, first of all, it would be do nothing. Backing dictators is what got us in this mess in the first place. But outright backing Al-Qaeda revolutions against those dictators is not the preferred policy. Thank you. Was I clear? I don't mean to say that I'm for supporting Assad, but supporting the rebels against them, it's treason. If this week hasn't made that clear, then I don't know what to do for you. It's treason. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, y'all, how's things? Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out the website. It's getting newer and improveder all the time over there at scotthorton.org. I'm working on the bookstore, the sticker store. Dave's got a new kind of a sub, sort of an updated kind of a theme going on there. Click on my sponsors. Make them some money. Okay. Let's take some calls. Obviously, the most important subject of the day is what's going on in Iraq and Syria, but there's a lot of other stuff going on too, so anything you want to bring to my attention or questions you want to ask or accusations you want to level or whatever, feel free. The number is 512-271-4836, 512-271-4836, and we already got one caller lined up, so, hey, how's it going? Welcome to the show. Did it work? No, I'm going to click it again. There we go. Hey.
Hey, Scott. It's Fitz out in the Bay Area. How are you?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. One thing I was wanting to talk about, although I apologize if you've already talked about this. I've been kind of in and out with work, but and I didn't know if Hillary Leverett talked as much about the Iran deal that or whether the deal Iran's trying to make, because I was just reading Garrett's column from today about how they're he was outlining how Zarif, their foreign minister, who used to be the their I guess their ambassador to the UN, how he had spent his time at the UN talking to all the kinds of scientists around the U.S. and other European countries and trying to say, hey, you know, what can we do to make this doable, where we can have a civilian nuclear program, and has basically outlined one where it would be literally impossible for them to ever convert it into a bomb. But the one thing that was interesting to me, and it looked like a very doable deal, but it required them to ship in their material, the low-enriched material, to Russia for up. And it just seems like that's the one thing I would worry about, to run a wrench in this, is that if we keep screwing up and inciting Russia, they might back out of one have any part of any kind of peace deal.
Right. It's funny. Today, I did not even get a chance to talk about that with her. Because we focused on, ISIS and Syria and Iraq policy and all of that. However, I did speak with Yosef Butt earlier in the show about that, and I don't know if you saw, but Gareth Porter has a brand spanking new one out. It's on antiwar.com right now. It should be in the top. There are a lot of top headlines on antiwar.com today. God, it's like the bad old days over here. Jesus, look at this. Gareth Porter interviews Iran foreign minister. On nuclear plan is the headline there. And I spoke about that. I haven't had a chance to talk with Gareth, but I did speak a little bit about, along these lines with Yosef Butt. And we talked about how far they've already said that they're willing to go here in basically converting all of their gas to metal, which makes it a hell of a lot more difficult anyway to convert it back to gas and then to higher enriched U-235, et cetera, et cetera. Like you're saying, show how far they're willing to go to build these confidence to reassure the Americans. One of the other things we talked about was how the Iraq reactor is really no threat, and yet still they're willing to go and do these, six extra things, reconfigure it maybe to make it a light water reactor, and just anything I can do to calm your fears kind of an attitude. So, I'm not saying that the Americans ought to go in there. Well, whatever. I don't think it's a threat in the first place. So, yeah, I do. The Americans ought to just go in there and shake hands. Whatever. That's fine. But, they don't have to believe these guys. They could still have whatever verification in the world under the safeguards agreement they've already got. They'll probably get an additional protocol. In other words, it's true. Like you say, the American side could sabotage this by just asking for such concessions that they just make it impossible. But on the other hand, maybe they're just building themselves up a high position to climb down from and still be at, what they see as a pretty damn reasonable, from the American point of view, a pretty reasonable, deal from the Iranians of what they're willing to concede. It is a negotiation after all, but with all that's going on, all the differences between America and Russia right now and all that's going on. And, I'm not sure. I was asking Yosef Butt, maybe it's a stupid question for him, but I'm not sure whether America and Iran working together again in Iraq against Al-Qaeda is helpful for an Iranian nuclear deal or whether it's kind of embarrassing. So maybe it'll make them less likely to do an Iranian nuclear deal because it all comes down to these kind of stupid politics, right? It's not the national security advisor. It's the political advisor who really decides at the end of the damn day. So
it's like you were saying, it'll require these, talking head idiots, on the media to actually climb over that wall to actually admit the truth of like, hey, we're actually on the same side here as Iran, it could actually help us. But the one thing I worry about, with this deal is it would require us, getting Putin's help, which he had offered in the past, but, we keep inciting him time for time. I mean, he might back out of that, and then probably the only option would be maybe like the French, but I mean the Iranians don't want to do that because they've been screwed over by the French in the past on our nuclear issues also.
Right.
So.
Yep. Yeah.
Anyway, well, thanks
very much.
I appreciate it. But yeah, hopefully next time we have the leverage on. I know the other issues definitely took precedence today, but I'd love to hear the Flynn or Hillary on again to talk about this latest on this.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fair to say that overall, the Leverets are pessimistic from what I've read of them and what I've heard from them on the nuclear deal that, they really have been saying that it's going to take sort of a Nixon-Kissinger effort to say, first, we're friends again, okay? And then we'll negotiate all the damned outstanding issues. Because if they take them piecemeal, there's too many other political pressures, waiting in the wings to sabotage the effort. So I know that's their overriding point of view from the book, and I think I haven't heard any indication of change from that. I mean, I think we all would like to be cautiously optimistic about this, but then again, you know, Gareth Porter doesn't think it's going anywhere either. So that means the most to me, really.
But anyway. Okay, well, I'll keep cursing at the wind then. Thanks.
Yeah, do that. I'll be there. See ya. All right. Anybody else wants to call us? 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And, you know, I don't know, man. Again, this Iran deal, and I'm such a broken record. This is why I want this deal signed so bad. I'm just so tired of talking about it. Oh, the Iranian nuclear program. It's such a big, fake, stupid, outstanding issue. It ought to be easy to push to the side. Oh, yeah, that last big, fake, not even real, outstanding issue between us. Let's go ahead and just, here, you sign here and I'll sign there, and okay, good. We'll be friends and we'll open trade and then, anyway. What a shame. America's policy in the Middle East is such a disaster. I don't know. All right. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. There's more than a few people lurking around in the chat room there. I guess if you guys want to talk by way of the chat room, I'll answer your questions that way, or any other topics you want me to bring up, or, you know, minor points. I'll go ahead and complain this because it's worth complaining. I saw, God, it's like I'm living in a nightmare, man. It's so unfair, this world. That's not what I'm complaining about. It's not that it's unfair. It's that it's so damned absurd. It's just, it's incongruent, man. It's out of whack. It's taken a skew to a tangent to an opposite timeline where everything is wrong. Like, for example, Jonah Goldberg wrote a thing at the American Enterprise Institute website about, yeah, this and that is what should be done about Iraq now. You son of a bitch. What? No, it just can't be. I went to write some smart alecky on my Twitter, and then I looked to the right, and it was Jonah Goldberg saying this, that, whatever about Iraq. At the AEI Twitter feed coming at me here. These are the guys who did it. His was the quote, every 10 years, the U.S. needs to pick up a crappy little country and slam it against the wall just to say we mean business. Paraphrasing that AEI's Michael Ledeen, talking about Iraq, Baghdad, Delenda Est, by Jonah Goldberg. Hey y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my goddamn show. It's called Show. They got Max Boot. They got Max Boot telling you what to do on the TV there if you need some of that. Boy, Max, he knows what to do. Oh, God almighty. Oh, Max. Oh, Max Boot. All right, well, yeah, so I'm Scott. This is my goddamn show, man, where I face palm all day. And now I have a big handprint of my own hand on my own face. From all day long saying things like, ah, Max Boot. Max Boot. On CNN. CNN, they couldn't think of a single person who knows a single thing about the Middle East better than Max Boot to say what ought to be done now. Well, I know what he's saying, hard Wilsonian that he is. America has to fix it. It's America's unwillingness to fix it gooder that made it this way, and so now it needs to fix it gooder than before it fixed it. That's what he's saying. I have it on closed caption. direct translation there. Actually, the closed caption is not working on Mac's boot. Maybe the closed transcriptionist lady has gone to puke. Huh. Anyway, that's what he's saying. America kill people, blah, blah. Well, here's my thing. My argument is absolute non-intervention. And I got to tell you, I really am taking this whole new rise of a bin Ladenite state seriously. You could have a Sunni state that's not ruled by a secularist general, that's still not ruled by bin Ladenite suicide bomber, prisoner, crucifier, heart-eating lunatics. But that's what this is. And it's new bin Ladenstan, dude. This is not cool. However, not even however. Therefore, the solution obviously is to stop intervening over there. Simple as that. Must stop with the intervention. It's U.S. intervention that created this mess. And if Bush was an idiot for being a clumsy fool and doing it all wrong and leading to terrible consequences, like training up a generation of radical Sunni fighters against our guys as their targets and giving them a gigantic, lawless Wild West and Northwest of Iraq to run around in, then the brilliant, genius Harvard Law School three-dimensional chess master Barack Obama has just gone and double-tripled down on Bush's error by backing these very same Mujahideen in Syria. So now you tell me, Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton? Hillary, who's saying Barack's only problem is he didn't bomb who she wanted enough? That is Assad? He didn't support these Al-Qaeda rebels against Assad enough is her problem with Obama? And now these are the technocratic, scientific, political heroes of America who are, they're going to solve this problem. Is that it? Or how about Rand Paul? We're going to send Rand Paul to prosecute a war against the new Jihadistan where Iraq, you know, between Baghdad and Homs, where Iraq and Syria used to be. You know, which cowboy on which horse mid which stream is supposed to handle this problem without making it worse? If all George Bush could do is make it 100,000 times worse, and then all Barack Obama can do is make it 100,000 times worse than that with their horrible so-called wars on terrorism. We've got to just stop. And here's what we have going for us. Because I know it's a horrible thing, but it's such an apt quote, really, to capture the feeling, the idea from Thomas Jefferson talking about slavery. Coward that he was. We have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither safely hold him nor let him go. The wolf being his completely oppressed and dehumanized slaves in that reference. But that's the attitude that the American people have as well as the American government. That can we really just leave a battlefield full of these crazies and who knows what's going to happen to them or us after this kind of a thing? My answer is yes. Let them go. They are wolves. Hell of a lot in a way that you could never characterize the former slaves of the United States. Come on, man. Sick bastards. But these guys, yeah. But I still say let them go. Wolves that they are. Because here's the thing about it. They're such bastards. And, you know, it's unfair for the people of Syria and Iraq, but I'm just talking about from this day forward. That's the best we can talk about, right? It's halfway through June 2014 here. As soon as America stops backing them and stops backing dictators against them, as soon as America tells the Saudis, hey, knock off your support for all these jihadis, and as soon as the people of Mosul have to live under these guys' pretended authority again, the sooner this whole thing will be over. Because as the Al-Qaeda guys proved, as has been referenced on this show, today and previously, when the Sunni tribal leaders in 2006, before Petraeus came to town with his surge at the beginning of 07. In 2006, they decided, we don't like you guys anymore, conscripting our sons, cutting our hands off, banning cigarette smoking, and this kind of ridiculous kind of clampdown. Prothero, on the show yesterday, Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers, talked about the very same effect. And these guys are such brutal bastards. Everywhere they go, they end up being rejected by the locals. They don't have any kind of real grassroots authority. And now, you know, it's true, warlords can take over regions and hold on. It's possible, but, you know, I don't know. In Sunni Iraqistan, where every man's got a rifle and just has lived through years of war, they need that consent of the governed to govern there. It won't be democracy, but they need some consent. ISIS will not just rule unless they have people who want to do what they say. And so I think, well, they could reform and become nice. Some reports are that they've been instructed, leave people alone. Don't destroy hearts and minds immediately upon sacking Mosul. But how long you expect that to last? Come on. There's a 99.999% chance that they're going to act just like the horrible bastards that they are. And being many of them foreigners that they are, that the Sunni Iraqis will awaken all over again and marginalize them all over again. And we'll have the rule of the big man among the different Sunni tribal chiefs and religious leaders and former Ba'athist generals, rather than a bunch of, bin Ladenite berserkers. That's the most likely result of this. You want to drain the swamp, quit filling it first, at least. And, you know, of course, the Republican narrative is, oh, Obama should have never left Iraq, but they should have never gone to Iraq. And the more they stayed, the more Al-Qaeda there were. And the Al-Qaeda didn't really start, as the Saudis turned on them. But what really undermined support for them was the Americans quit rampaging through the Sunni areas. They basically called the ceasefire. They renamed them the Iraqi Sunni militias. They renamed them the Sons of Iraq, the concerned local citizens, the former insurgency, and quit fighting them. And then support for the Mujahideen completely just evaporated. And, you know, everywhere they go in Syria, they're brutal bastards too. I mean, they have been able to get electricity and oil going and other government services, court systems and things, and they're trying hard to build the state here. And maybe they have learned from Zarqawi's public relations mistakes. But I think that there's no reason to think that Sunni Arabs left undictated to by American sock puppet dictators must or would by, the force of nature or something create governments run by people like ISIS or allow something like this proto little wannabe caliphate thing they're creating to last that long. Again, I don't think Maliki will ever own those areas of Iraq again, probably, but that doesn't mean that ISIS has to either. So, America, hands off. You've done enough damage. Can't possibly solve it.